There was certainly that conscious element in those RCA days from the end of 65 to summer of 66 of pushing the envelope in milder ways. There was Paint It Black, for example, recorded in March 1966, our sixth British number one. Brian Jones, now transformed into a multi-instrumentalist, having given up playing the guitar, played sitar. It was a different style to everything I'd done before. Maybe it was the Jew in me. It's more to me like having a gila or some gypsy lick. Maybe I picked it up from my granddad. It's definitely on a different curve to everything else. I've moved around the world a bit. I was no longer strictly a Chicago blues man. I had to spread the wings a bit to come up with melodies and ideas. Although I can't say that we ever played Tel Aviv or Romania. But you start to latch on to different things. With songwriting, it's a constant experiment. I've never done it consciously, like saying, oh, I've got to explore such and such a thing. We were learning about making the album the centre of attention, the form for the music, instead of just singles. Making an LP usually consisted of having two or three single hits and their B-sides, and then filler. Everything was 2 minutes, 29 seconds for a single. Otherwise, you wouldn't get played on the radio. I talked to Paul McCartney about this recently. We changed it. Every track was a potential single. There was no filler. And if there was, it was an experiment. We'd use the extended time we had with an album just to make more of a statement. If LPs hadn't existed, probably the Beatles and ourselves wouldn't have lasted more than 2.5 years. You had to keep condensing, reducing what it was you wanted to say to please the distributor. Otherwise, radio stations wouldn't play it. Dylan's Visions of Joanna was the breakthrough. Going Home was 11 minutes long. It ain't going to be a single. Can you extend and expand the product? Can it be done? And that was really the main experiment. We said, you can't edit this shit. It either goes out like it is, or you're done with it. I've no doubt Dylan felt the same about Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands or Visions of Joanna. The record got bigger. And could anybody listen to that much? It's over 3 minutes. Can you keep their attention? Can you keep your audience? But it worked. The Beatles and ourselves probably made the album the vehicle for recording and hastened the demise of the single. It didn't go away immediately. You always needed a hit single. It just extended you without your even really knowing it. And because you've been playing every day, sometimes two or three shows a day, ideas are flowing. One thing feeds the other. You might be having a swim or screwing the old lady, but somewhere in the back of your mind, you're thinking about this chord sequence or something related to a song. No matter what the hell's going on, you might be getting shot at, and you'll still be, that's the bridge, and there's nothing you can do. You don't realise it's happening. It's totally subconscious, unconscious, or whatever. The radar is on, whether you know it or not. You cannot switch it off. You hear this piece of conversation from across the room, I just can't stand you anymore. That's a song. It just flows in. And also, the other thing about being a songwriter, when you realise you are one, is that to provide ammo, you start to become an observer. You start to distance yourself. You're constantly on the alert. That faculty gets trained in you over the years, observing people, how they react to one another, which in a way makes you weirdly distant. You shouldn't really be doing it. It's a little bit of peeping Tom to be a songwriter. You start looking round and everything is a subject for a song. The banal phrase, which is the one that makes it. And you say, I can't believe nobody hooked up on that one before. Luckily, there are more phrases than songwriters, just about. Linda Keith was the one that first broke my heart. It was my fault. I asked for it and I got it. Her first look was the deepest. Watching her, with all her tricks and movements, fearfully, from across the room and feeling that hit of longing and thinking, she's out of my league. I was sometimes in awe of the women I was with at the start because, I mean, they were the creme de la creme and I come from the gutter as far as I was concerned. I didn't believe these beautiful women wanted to say hello, let alone lie down with me. Linda and I met at a party given by Andrew Oldham, a party of some forgotten Jagger Richards written single. It was the party where Mick first met Marion Faithfull. Linda was 17, strikingly beautiful, very dark hair, the perfect look for the 60s, a blinder, very self-assured in her jeans and a white shirt. She was in a magazine, she was modelling. David Bailey was photographing her. Not that she was particularly interested. The girl just wanted something to do to get out of the house. When I first met Linda, I was just astounded that she wanted to come along with me. Once again, the girl puts the make on me. She bedded me. I didn't bed her. She made a line straight for me, and I was totally, absolutely in love. We fell for each other. And the other surprise was that I was Linda's first love, the first boy she ever fell for. She'd been actively pursued by all kinds of people who she'd rejected. To this day, I don't understand it. Linda was the best friend of Andrew Oldham's then almost wife, Sheila Klein. These beautiful Jewish girls were a powerful cultural force in West Hampstead, Bohemia, which became my stomping ground and mixed too for a couple of years. It centred around Broadhurst Gardens, West Hampstead, near where Decca Records was situated, and a few venues around there where we played. Linda's father was Alan Keith, who for 44 years presented a programme on BBC Radio called Your 100 Best Tunes. Linda had been allowed to grow up fairly wild. She loved music. Jazz, blues. A blues purist, in fact, who didn't really approve of the Rolling Stones. She never did. She probably doesn't now. She had been hanging out when she was very young at a place called the Roaring Twenties, a black club, when she was wandering around London in bare feet. The Stones played every night. We were on the road all the time. But still somehow, for a while, Linda and I managed to have a love affair. We lived first in Mapesbury Road, then in Holly Hill, with Mick and his girlfriend Christy Shrimpton. And finally, it was just the two of us in Carlton Hill, the flat I had in St. John's Wood. The rooms there never got decorated. Everything piled up around the walls, mattress on the floor, many guitars, an upright piano. We lived, despite all of this, almost like a married couple. We used to take the tube before I bought Linda a Mark II Jag, which had a letterbox 45 player on which she wouldn't play the Stones. We'd hang out in Chelsea at the Casserole, the Marigiana, the Baghdad House. The restaurant we went to in Hampstead is still there, Le Cellier du Midi, and probably still has the same menu after 4 years. It certainly looks identical from the outside. It was bound to unravel with the long absences. through confusion more than anything. A confusion of suddenly living this life that nobody, or certainly nobody that I knew, had a roadmap for. All of us were pretty young. We're trying to make this thing up as we went along. I'm going to America for 3 months. So I love you, darling. And meanwhile, we're all changing. For one thing, I've met Ronnie Bennett, and I spent more time on the road with her than I did with Linda. We grew apart slowly. It took a couple of years. We would still hook up, but in those years, the band had a total of 10 days off for the entire 3-year period. Linda and I did manage to have one brief holiday in the south of France, though Linda remembers this as a flight she took away from London in escape, a job as a waitress in Saint-Tropez, and me following her and installing her in a hotel, giving her a hot bath. Linda also began taking a lot of drugs. For me to disapprove is an irony, but I did disapprove then. I've seen Linda a couple of times since those days. She's happily married to a very well-known record producer, John Porter. She remembers my disapproval. I was taking a little more than weed in those days, but Linda, she was getting into the heavy stuff, and it was having a dangerous effect on her. That was clear to see. She came with me to New York when we were touring the USA in the summer of 1966, our fifth tour there. I put her up at the Americana Hotel, though she spent much of her time with her girlfriend, Roberta Goldstein. When I turned up, they put all the gear away, the downers, the chewinals, which I wouldn't have touched. Imagine! And strewn wine bottles around to give probable cause if they staggered a bit. And then she met Jimi Hendrix, saw him play, and adopted his career as her mission. Tried to get him a recording contract with Andrew Oldham. In her enthusiasm, during a long evening with Jimmy, as she tells it, she gave him a Fender Stratocaster of mine that was in my hotel room. And then, so Linda says, she also picked up a copy of a demo I had of Tim Rose singing a song called Hey Joe, and took that round to Roberta Goldstein's where Jimmy was and played it to him. This is rock and roll history. So he got the song from me, apparently. We went off on tour, and when I came back, London was suddenly hippieville. I was already into that in America, but I wasn't expecting it when I came home to London. The scene had changed totally in a matter of weeks. Linda was on acid, and I'd been jilted. You shouldn't expect somebody that age to hang around for 4 months with all this stuff going on. I knew it was on the break. It was my presumptuousness to think she's going to sit like a little old lady at home at 18 or 19 years old while I gallivanted around the world doing what I wanted. I found out that Linda had taken up with some poet, which I went bananas about. I went running through the whole of London, asking people, anybody seen Linda? Crying my eyes out from St. John's Wood to Chelsea, screaming, bitch, get out of my fucking way! Fuck the traffic lights! I only remember some very close accidents, nearly getting run over on the way through London to Chelsea. After I found out, I wanted to be sure. I wanted to see. I checked with my friends, where does this motherfucker live? I even remember his name. Bill Chanel. Some poet, so-called. He was a hip little bugger at the time because he came on with the Dylan-esque bit. Couldn't play anything. Ersatz hip, as it's called. I stalked her a couple of times, but I remember thinking, what would I say? I hadn't got that act down yet, how to confront my rival. In the middle of a wimpy bar, or some bistro? I even walked to where she was living with him in Chelsea, almost in the Fulham, and stood outside. This is a love story, and I could see her in there with him, silhouettes on the shade. And that was it, like a thief in the night. That's the first time I felt the deep cut. The thing about being a songwriter is even if you've been fucked over, you can find consolation in writing about it and pour it out. Everything has something to do with something. Nothing is divorced. It becomes an experience, a feeling, or a conglomeration of experiences. Basically, Linda is Ruby Tuesday. But our story wasn't quite over. After she left me, Linda was in a really bad way. Chewinals had given way to harder stuff. She went back to New York and took up further with Jimi Hendrix, who may have broken her heart as she broke mine. Certainly her friends say she was very much in love with him, but I knew she needed medical help. She was getting very close to the danger line, as she herself acknowledged later, and I couldn't deal with it because I'd burn my boats. I went to see her parents, and I gave them all the telephone numbers and places where they'd find her. Hey, your daughter is in distress. She won't admit it, but you've got to do something. I can't. I'm already persona non grata anyway. And this is going to be the final nail in my coffin with Linda. But you've got to do something about her because I'm on the road tomorrow. Linda's father went to New York and found her in a nightclub, brought her back to England, where her passport was removed and she was made a ward of court. She felt that this was a great betrayal on my part, and we didn't speak or see each other again until many years later. She had some close shaves with drugs after that, but she survived and recovered, brought up a family. She now lives in New Orleans. On a rare day off between tours, I did manage to buy Redlands, the house I still own in West Sussex near Chichester Harbour. The house where we were busted, which burned down twice. The house I still love. We just spoke to each other the minute we saw each other. A thatched house, it was quite small, surrounded by a moat. I drove up there by mistake. I had a brochure with a couple of houses marked, and I'm punching around in my Bentley. Oh, I'm going to buy a house. I took a wrong turn, and I turned into Redlands. This guy walks out, very nice guy, and he says, yeah. I said, oh, sorry, we've come to the wrong turning. He said, yeah, you want to go Fishbourne way. And he said, are you looking for a house to buy? He was very pucker, an ex-commodore of the Royal Navy. And I said, yes. And he said, well, there's no sign up, but this house is for sale. I looked at him and I said, how much? Because I fell in love with Redlands the minute I saw it. Nobody's going to let this thing go. It's too picturesque, ideal. He said, 20 grand. This is about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and the banks are open till 3. I said, you going to be here this evening? He said, yes, of course. I said, if I bring you down 20 grand, can we do the deal? So I zoomed up to London, just got to the bank in time, got the bread, 20 grand and a brown paper bag. And by evening, I was back down at Redlands in front of the fireplace and we signed the deal. And he turned over the deeds to me. It was like cash on the barrel head, done in really an old-fashioned way. By the end of 1966, we were all exhausted. We'd been on the road without a break for almost 4 years. The crack-ups were coming. We'd already had a wobbler with the formidable but brittle Andrew Oldham in Chicago in 1965 when we were recording at Chess. Andrew was a lover of speed. But this time he was drunk too and very distressed about his relationship with Sheila, his old lady at the time. He started waving a shooter around in my hotel room. This we didn't need. I hadn't come all the way to Chicago to get shot by some wonky public schoolboy whose gun barrel I was staring down, which looks very ominous at the time, that little black hole. Mick and I got the gun away from him, slapped him around a bit, put him to bed and forgot about it. I don't even know what happened to the shooter, an automatic. Tossed it out the window, probably. We're just getting going. Let's make this, forget it. But Brian was a different story. What was comic about Brian was his illusions of grandeur even before he got famous. He thought it was his band for some weird reason. A first demonstration of Brian's aspirations was the discovery on our first tour that he was getting £5 more a week than the rest of us, because he persuaded Eric Easton that he was our leader. The whole deal with the band was we split everything like pirates. You put the booty on a table and you split it, pieces of eight. Jesus Christ, who do you think you are? I'm writing the songs round here and you're getting £5 extra a week. Get out of here. It started with little things like that, which then exacerbated the friction between us as it went on and he became more and more outrageous. In the early negotiations, it was always Brian who would go to the meetings as our leader. We were not permitted by Brian. I remember Mick and me once waiting for the results round the block, sitting in Lyons Corner House. It happened so fast, after we did a couple of TV shows, Brian turned into this sort of freak, devouring celebs and fame and attention. Mick and Charlie and I were looking at it all a bit sceptically. This is shit you've got to do to make records. But Brian, and he was not a stupid guy, fell right into it. He loved the adulation. The rest of us didn't think it was bad, but you don't fall for it all the way. I felt the energy. I knew there was something big happening, but some guys get stroked and they just can't get over it. Stroke me some more, stroke me some more, and suddenly I'm a star. I never saw a guy so much affected by fame. The minute we'd had a couple of successful records, zoom, he was Venus and Jupiter rolled into one. Huge inferiority complex that you hadn't noticed. The minute the chick started screaming, he seemed to go through a whole change just when we didn't need it, when we needed to keep the whole thing tight and together. I've known a few that were really carried away by fame, but I never saw one that changed so dramatically overnight. No, we're just getting lucky, pal. This is not fame. It went to his head, and over the next few years of very difficult road work in the mid-60s, we could not count on Brian at all. He was getting really stoned, out of it. He thought he was an intellectual, a mystic philosopher. He was very impressed by other stars, but only because they were stars, not because of what they were good at. And he became a pain in the neck, a kind of rotting attachment. When you're schlepping 350 days a year on the road and you got to drag a dead weight, it becomes pretty vicious. We were on a swing through the Midwest and Brian's asthma got him and he was in hospital in Chicago. And hey, when a guy's sick, you double for him. But then we saw pictures of him zooming around Chicago. hanging at a party with so-and-so, fawning over stars with that silly little bow around his neck. We'd done 3-4 gigs without him. That's double duty for me, pal. There's only 5 of us, and the whole point of the band is that it's a 2-guitar band. And suddenly, there's only 1 guitar. So I've got to figure out whole new ways to play all these songs. I've got to perform Brian's part as well. I learned a lot about how to do 2 parts at once, or how to distill the essence of what his part was and still play what I had to play and throw in a few licks. But it was damn hard work. And I never got a thank you from him, ever, for covering his ass. He didn't give a shit. I was out of it. That's all I would get. All right, are you going to give me your pay? Well, that's when I had it in for Brian. One can get very sarcastic on the road and quite vicious. Just shut up, you little creep. Preferred it when you weren't here. He had this way of ranting on, saying things that were just great. When I played with so-and-so, he was totally starstruck. I saw Bob Dylan yesterday. He doesn't like you. But he had no idea how obnoxious he was being. So it would start off, oh, shut up, Brian. Or we'd imitate the way he cringed his head into his non-existent neck. And then it went to baiting him in a way. He had this huge Humber Super Snipe car, but he was a pretty short guy, and he had to have a cushion to see over the steering wheel. Mick and I would steal the cushion for a laugh, you know, wicked schoolboy sort of stuff. Sitting at the back of the bus, we just let him have it, pretending he wasn't there. Where's Brian? Shit, did you see what he was wearing yesterday? It was the pressure of work. And the other side of it was that you hoped that kind of shock treatment would snap him out of it. There's no time to take time off and say, let's sort this out. But it was a love-hate relationship with Brian. He could be really funny. I used to enjoy hanging with him, figuring out how Jimmy Reed or Muddy Waters did this or T-Bone Walker did that. What probably really stuck in Brian's craw was when Mick and I started writing the songs. He lost his status and then lost interest. Having to come to the studio and learn to play a song Mick and I had written would bring him down. It was like Brian's open wound. Brian's only solution became clinging to either Mick or me, which created a triangle of sorts. He had it in for Andrew Alden, Mick and me. He thought there was a conspiracy to roll them out, which wasn't true at all. But somebody's got to write the songs. You're quite welcome. I'll sit around and write a song with you. What have you come up with? But no sparks flew when I was sitting around with Brian. And then it was, I don't like guitar anymore. I want to play marimbas. Another time, pal. We've got a tour to do. So we got to rely on him not being there. And if he turned up, it was a miracle. When he was there and came to life, he was incredibly nimble. He could pick up any instruments that were lying around and come up with something. Sitar and paint it black. The marimbas on Under My Thumb. But for the next 5 days, we won't see the motherfucker, and we've still got a record to make. We've got sessions lined up, and where's Brian? Nobody can find him, and when they do, he's in a terrible condition. He barely ever played guitar in the last few years with us. Our whole thing was 2 guitars, and everything else wove around that. And when the other guitar ain't there half the time, or has lost interest in it, you start getting overdubbing. A lot of those records is me 4 times. I learned a lot more about recording doing that. And also, how to cover unexpected situations. And just by the process of overdubbing and talking to the engineers, I learned a lot more about microphones, about amplifiers, about changing sounds of guitars, because if you've got one guitar player playing all the parts, if you're not careful, it sounds like it. What you really want is to make them each sound different. On albums like December's Children in Aftermath, I did the parts that Brian normally would have done. Sometimes I'd overlay 8 guitars and then maybe just use one bar of the take here and there and the mixing. So at the end of it, it sounds like it's 2 or 3 guitars and you're not even counting anymore. But it's actually 8 in there and they're just in and out in the mix. Then Brian met Anita Pallenberg. He met her backstage around September 1965 at the show in Munich. She followed us to Berlin, where there was a spectacular riot. And then slowly, over several months, she started going out with Brian. She was working hard as a model and travelling about. But eventually she came to London and she and Brian began their relationship. Soon enough, its bouts of high-volume violence. Brian graduated from his Humber Snipe to a Rolls Royce, but he couldn't see out of that either. Acid came into his picture around the same time. Brian disappeared late 1965 when we were in mid-tour with the usual complaints of ill health, and he surfaced in New York, jamming with Bob Dylan, hanging with Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground, and doing acid. Acid to Brian was something different than to your average drug taker. The dope at the time really wasn't, at least as far as the rest of us were concerned, a big deal. We were only smoking weed and taking a few uppers to keep us going. Acid made Brian feel he was one of an elite, like the acid test. It was that cliquishness. He wanted to be a part of something, could never find anything to be part of. I don't remember anybody else going about saying, "I've taken acid." But Brian saw it as a sort of Congressional Medal of Honor. And then he'd come on, like, "You wouldn't know, man, I've been tripping." And he's primping himself. That terrible primping, the hair. The little idiosyncrasies became so annoying. It was the typical drug thing. Yeah, they think they're somebody special. It's the head club. You meet people who'd say, "Are you a head?" as if it conferred some special status. People who were stoned on something you hadn't taken. Their elitism was total bullshit. Ken Kesey's got a lot to answer for. I remember well the episode Andrew Oldham describes in his memoir and gives such symbolic weight to. When Brian lay collapsed on the floor of the RCA studio in March 1966, straddling his guitar, which was buzzing and interfering with the sound. Someone had to unplug it, and in Andrew's telling, it was as if Brian were being cast adrift forever. To me, it was just an annoying noise, and the concept was not something we were particularly shocked about, because Brian had been toppling over here and there for days. He really loved to take too many downers, seconals, tuinals, desputules, the whole range. You think you're playing Segovia and think it's going diddle diddle diddle, but actually it's going dum dum dum. You can't work with a broken band. If there's something wrong in the engine, an attempt has to be made to fix it. In something like the Stones, especially at that time, you can't just say, "Fuck it, you're fired." And at the same time, things couldn't go on with this really rancorous fishing. And then Anita introduced Brian to the other lot, the camels and that particular set, of which there will be more bad news. Chapter 6, in which I get busted in Redlands, escape to Morocco in the Bentley, do a moonlight flit with Anita Pallenberg, make my first courtroom appearance, spend a night in the scrubs, and a summer in Rome. Cecil Beaton in Morocco, 1967. From Self-Portrait with Friends, the Selected Diaries of Cecil Beaton, 1926 to 1974. No group makes more of a mess at the table. The aftermath of their breakfast with eggs, jam, honey everywhere is quite exceptional. They give a new meaning to the word untidiness. The drummer, Keith, as it was written, of the Stones, an 18th century suit, long black velvet coat and the tightest pants. Everything is shoddy, poorly made, the seams burst. Keith himself had sewn his trousers, lavender and dull rose, with a band of badly stitched leather dividing the two colours. Brian appears in white pants with a huge black square applied at the back. It is very smart, in spite of the fact that the seams are giving way. 1967 was the watershed year, the year the seams gave way. There was that feeling that trouble was coming, which it did later, with all the riots, street fighting and all of that. It was a tension in the air. It's like negative and positive ions before a storm. You get that breathlessness that something's got to break. In fact, all it did was crack. We'd finished touring the previous summer, a grueling American tour. And wouldn't tour there again for 2 years. In all that time, the first 4 years of the band, I don't think we ever had more than 2 days rest between playing, travelling and recording. We were always on the road. I felt I'd come to the end of an episode with Brian. At least it couldn't go on as it had while we were touring. Mick and I had gotten incredibly nasty to Brian when he became a joke, when he effectively gave up his position in the band. Things had been bad before that, too. I mean, there had been tension way before Brian started becoming an arsehole. But I was trying to mend fences at the end of 1966. We were a band, after all. I was footloose, fancy-free, having ended my affair with Linda Keith. And when Brian wasn't working, it was easier. And naturally, I gravitated to Brian's and Anita's Courtfield Road, near Gloucester Road. We had a lot of fun, becoming friends again, getting stoned together. It was wonderful at first. So I started to move in with him. Brian saw my attempts to bring him back into the centre as an opportunity to start a vendetta against Mick. Brian always had to have an imaginary enemy, and around this time he decided it was Mick Jagger who had grossly mistreated and offended him. I just hung out as a guest and got a ringside seat on the world that Anita attracted around her, which was an exceptional gang of people. I used to walk back through Hyde Park to St. John's Wood at 6 in the morning at first, just to pick up a clean shirt. And then I just stopped going home. In those days on Courtfield Road, I had nothing to do with Anita, strictly speaking. I was fascinated by her from what I thought was a safe distance. I thought certainly that Brian had got very lucky. I could never figure out how he got his hands on her. My first impression was of a woman who was very strong. I was right about that. Also an extremely bright woman. That's one of the reasons she sparked me. let alone that she was so entertaining and such a great beauty to look at. Very funny. Cosmopolitan beyond anyone I'd come across. She spoke three languages. She'd been here, she'd been there. It was very exotic to me. I loved her spirit. Even how she would instigate and turn the screw and manipulate, she wouldn't let you off the hook for a minute. If I said, "That's nice," she would say, "Nice? I hate that word. Oh, stop being so fucking bourgeois. We're going to fight about the word nice? How would you know?" Her English was still a bit patchy, so she would break out in German occasionally when she really meant something. "Excuse me, I'll have that translated." Anita, sexy fucking bitch. One of the prime women in the world. It was all building up in Courtfield Gardens. Brian would crash out sometimes, and Anita and I would look at each other. But that's Brian and his old lady, and that's it, hands off. The idea of stealing a band member's woman was not on my agenda, and so the days went by. The truth was, I'm looking at Anita, and I'm looking at Brian, and I'm looking at her, and I'm thinking, there's nothing I can do about this. I'm going to have to be with her. I'm going to have her, or she's going to have me, one way or another. The realization didn't help things. There was this obvious electricity over a few months, and Brian became more and more tangential. It took a lot of patience on my part. I'd stay around there 3 or 4 days. And once a week, I'd walk to St. John's Wood. Better give some space here. It's too transparent what my feelings are. But there were many other people around. It was a continuous party. Brian was desperately in need of attention all the time. But the more he got, the more he wanted. Also, I was getting the flavour of what was going on between Brian and Anita. I would hear the thumping some nights, and Brian would come out with a black eye. Brian was a woman beater. But the one woman in the world you did not want to try and beat up on was Anita Pallenberg. Every time they had a fight, Brian would come out bandaged and bruised. But it was nothing to do with me. Was it? I was there only to hang with Brian. Anita came out of an artistic world, and she had quite a bit of talent herself. She was certainly a lover of art, and Pally with its contemporary practitioners, wrapped up in the pop art world. Her grandfather and great-grandfather were painters, a family that had gone down, apparently, in a blaze of syphilis and madness. Anita could draw. She grew up in her grandfather's big house in Rome, but spent her teens in Munich at a decadent German aristocrat school where they threw her out for smoking, drinking, and worst of all, hitchhiking. When she was 16, she got a scholarship to a graphic school in Rome near the Piazza del Popolo, which was when she started hanging out at that tender age in the cafes with the Roman intelligentsia, Fellini and all those people, as she put it. Anita had a lot of style. She also had an amazing ability to put things together, to connect with people. This was Rome in the Dolce Vita period. She knew all the filmmakers, Fellini, Visconti, Pasolini. In New York, she connected with Warhol, the pop art world, and the beat poets. Mostly through her own skills, Anita was brilliantly connected to many worlds and many different people. She was the catalyst of so many goings-on in those days. If there was a genealogical tree, tree of genesis of London's hip scene, the one that it was known for in those days, Anita and Robert Fraser, the gallery owner and art dealer, would be at the top. Besides Christopher Gibbs, the antiques dealer and bibliophile, and a few other major courtiers. And that was mainly because of the connections they'd made. Anita had met Robert Fraser a long way back in 1961, when she was tied up with the early pop art world through her boyfriend Mario Schifano, a leading pop painter in Rome. Through Fraser, she'd met Sir Mark Palmer, the original Gypsy Baron, and Julian and Jane Ormsby Gore, and Tara Brown, subject of the Beatles' A Day in the Life. So already a basis is laid for the meeting of music, which played a big part in the art underground from early on, and the aristos, even though these were not your usual aristos. Here you had three old Etonians, Fraser, Gibbs, and Palmer. Though it turned out that two of them, Fraser and Gibbs, had been sacked from Eton or left prematurely, and each had special, eccentric talents and a strong personality. They were not born to follow the herd. Mick and Marianne would make pilgrimages with John Mitchell, a writer, and the Merlin of the group, to Herefordshire to observe flying saucers and ley lines and all that. Anita had a Paris life, dancing around nightly and diaphanously in regimes where they let her in for free. She had an equally glamorous Roman life. She worked as a model and she got parts in movies. The people she mixed with were hardcore avant-garde in the days when hardcore hardly existed. And that was when the drug culture had started to explode. First came the Mandrax with the grass, then the acid in late 66, then the coke sometime in 67, then the smack, always. I remember David Quartz, the original maker of my skull ring, still a close friend, coming out to dinner in a pub near Redlands. He'd had some Mandrax and some bevvies and now wanted to rest his head in the soup. I remember it only because Mick carried him on his back to the car. He would never do something like that now. And I realise, remembering that incident, how very long ago it was that Mick changed. But that is another country. Oh, they were some fascinating people. Captain Fraser, who'd had a commission in the King's African Rifles, the strong arm of colonial authority in East Africa, was posted in Uganda, where Idi Amin was his sergeant. He turned into Strawberry Bob, floating around in slippers and Rajasthani trousers by night, and gangster-sharp pinstripes and polka-dot suits by day. The Robert Fraser Gallery was pretty much the cutting edge. He was putting on Jim Dine shows. He represented Lichtenstein. He did Warhol's first thing in London, showing Chelsea girls in his flat. He showed Larry Rivers, Rauschenberg. Robert saw all the changes coming. He was very into pop art. He was aggressively avant-garde. I liked the energy that was going into it, rather than necessarily everything that was being done. It was that feeling in the air that anything was possible. Otherwise, the stunning, overblown pretentiousness of the art world made my skin crawl cold turkey. And I wasn't even using the stuff. Allen Ginsberg was staying at Mick's place in London once. I spent an evening listening to the old gas bag pontificating on everything. It was the period when Ginsberg sat around playing a concertina badly and making om sounds, pretending he was oblivious to his socialite surroundings. Captain Fraser really loved his Otis Redding and his Booker T and the MGs. I'd sometimes drop by his flat in Mount Street, the salon of the period, in the morning, if I'd been up all night. And I just got the new Booker T or Otis album. And there was Mohammed, the Moroccan servant in the Jalaba, preparing a couple of pipes, and we'd listen to Green Onions or Chinese Checkers, or Chained and Bound. Robert was into smack. He had a cupboard full of double-breasted suits, all superbly made, with great fabrics, and his shirts were often handmade bespoke shirts. But the collars and cuffs were always frayed, and that was part of the look. And he used to keep spare jacks, a sixth of a grain, it was six jacks to a grain of heroin, loose in these suit pockets. So he'd always be going to the cupboard and going through all the pockets to find the odd spare jack. Our Robert's flat was full of fantastic objects. Tibetan skulls lined with silver, bones with silver caps on the end, Tiffany Art Nouveau lamps, and beautiful fabrics, textiles everywhere. He'd float around in his bright-coloured silk shirts he brought back from India. Our Robert really liked to get stoned. Wonderful hashish. Afghani primo. He was a weird mixture of avant-garde and very old-fashioned. The other thing I really liked about Robert was he had no side on him. He could have easily hidden behind Eton and the patrician style, but he looked around. He deliberately showed works of art by people not in the Royal Academy. And then, of course, there was the homosexual pufta bit that also put him at odds. He didn't flaunt it, but he certainly didn't hide it. He had a steely eye, and I always admired his guts. And I put a lot of that persona of his down to the African rifles, really. He had his eyes open in Africa, Captain Robert Fraser, retired. If he wanted to, he could pull rank. But I have the feeling with Robert that he just detested more and more the way that the establishment at that time, as they called it, was still trying to cling on to something that was obviously crumbling. I admired his stand on, "This cannot go on." And I think that's why he attached himself to us and the Beatles and the avant-garde artists. Fraser and Christopher Gibbs had been at Eton together. When Anita first met Gibby, way back, he'd just come out of jail for taking a book from Sotheby's, age 18 or something. Always a passionate collector and with a very good eye. We linked up with Gibbs again through Robert when Mick decided he wanted to have a country life. Robert was not country inclined and said, "You better get Gibby onto this." So Gibbs started showing Mick and Marianne around England and they looked at various palaces and estates. I've always loved Gibby in his own way. I used to stay at his apartment at Cheyne Walk on the embankment. He had a great library of books. I could just sit around, look at beautiful first editions, and great illustrations and paintings and stuff that I hadn't had time to get into because I'd been working on the road, very much in the flogging the furniture. Very nice pieces. A subtle promoter of his own wares. I've got this wonderful chest, 16th century. He was always flogging something off, or something was always available. At the same time, he was crazy. Christopher, he's the only guy I know that would actually wake up and break an emyl nitrate popper under his nose. That even took me out. He'd have one by the side of the bed, just twist that little yellow file and wake up. I saw him do it. I was amazed. I didn't mind the poppers, but usually later at night. What Robert Fraser and Christopher Gibbs had in common was nerve and fearlessness, more front than Selfridges. And they were mama's boys. Big mama fear amongst a lot of them. Maybe that's why they were all puffs. Strawberry Bob. He was always scared of his mum. "Oh, my mother's coming." "So what?" Which didn't mean they were soft or pussy-whipped. It was just the respect for their mothers that was overpowering. Obviously, they had very strong mothers, because these guys were very strong guys. Only now have I learned that Gibby's mother was queen of the Girl Guides worldwide, the chief commissioner for overseas. It's not something we talked about in those days. I never realised the influence of this duo back then, but they changed the landscape and they greatly influenced the style of the times. Gibbs and Fraser were only the front names and all that. There were Lampsons and Lamptons, Sykeses, Michael Rainey. There was Sir Mark Palmer, page boy to the Queen, an inveterate didicoy, bless his heart. Him with the gold teeth and the whippets tied to baling twine, and the caravans that he used to trundle through the country lanes and park on the estates of his friends. I guess if you're brought up and trained to carry the Queen's frock, gypsy caravan might look kind of attractive after a while. It was all right before you got hair on your cock. But after that, what do? I haul the Queen's frock? Suddenly, we were being courted by half the aristocracy. The younger scions, the heirs to some ancient pile, the Ormsby Gores, the tenants, the whole lot. I've never known if they were slumming or we were snobbing. They were very nice people. I decided it was no skin off my nose. If somebody's interested, they're welcome. You want to hang? You want to hang. Yeah, it was the first time I know of when that lot actively sought out musicians in such large numbers. They realised there was something blowing in the wind, to quote Bob. They felt embarrassed up there, the knights in blue, and they felt they were being left out of things if they didn't join in. So there was this weird mixture of aristos and gangsters, the fascination that the higher end of society has with the more brutish end. And that was particularly the case with Robert Fraser. Robert liked to mix with the underworld. Maybe it was his rebellion against the suffocation of his background, or the repression of homosexuality. He gravitated towards people like David Litvinov, who was on the borders of art and villainy, a friend of the Cray brothers, the East End gangsters. Though there were villains in the story as well. Well, that's how Tony Sanchez came into it. Because Tony Sanchez helped Robert out of a tight spot when he had gambling debts. And that's how Robert met Tony. So Tony became Robert's conduit, sort of helper out with villains and his dealer. Tony rang a gambling casino for Spanish waiters in London after hours. He was a dope dealer and a gangster with a Mark 10 Jag, two-tone, all done up pimp style. His father ran a famous Italian restaurant in Mayfair. Spanish Tony was a hard man. Biff, bang, one of those. He was a great guy until he became a bad one. His trouble, just like many others, was that you can't be like that and also become a junkie. The two don't mix. If you're going to be a hard man, if you're going to be smart beyond your toes, which is what Tony could have been and was for a while, you can't afford to be on dope. It slows you down. If you're going to be selling it, okay, that's the way it is, but don't sample it. There's a big difference between a dealer and a consumer. To be a dealer, you've got to be way in front. Otherwise, you slip up. And that's what happened to Tony. He set me up a couple of times without my knowing it. I found out later. He used me as a getaway driver on a hit-and-run jewel theft in the Burlington Arcade. Here, Keith, I've got this Jag. Do you want to try it out? What they wanted was a clean car and a clean driver. And Tony had obviously told his blokes that I was a good night driver. So I waited outside this place, not knowing what was happening. Tony was a good mate of mine, but he used to stitch me up. Another good friend, Michael Cooper. I used to hang with a lot. Great photographer. He could hang and hang. He could take so much stuff. He was the only photographer I ever knew who actually had a tremor when he was taking pictures. And yet they'd come out right. How did you do that? Your hands were trembling. The whole picture should be a blur. Well, I know just when to push. Michael recorded the early Stones' life in great detail because he never stopped taking pictures. Pictures were a total way of life for Michael. He was absolutely captured by images. Or more likely, images had captured him. Michael was Robert's creature in a way. Robert had a Svengali side to him and was strongly attracted to Michael Cooper on all sorts of levels. But he particularly admired Michael's artistry, and he promoted him. Michael was a networker. He was the glue between us. All these different parts of London, the Aristos and the Hoods and the others. When you take all the stuff we took, you're always talking about everything else rather than what you're working at. Which meant Michael and me sitting around talking about the quality of the dope. Two fiends looking to see if they can get higher than ever before without damaging themselves too much. No talking about the great work I'm going to do or you're going to do or anybody else is going to do. I mean, that was peripheral. I knew how hard he worked. He was manic like me, but you took it for granted. One thing about Michael was that he would spiral into deep, ominous depressions. Black dogs. The poet of the lens was a more fragile creature than one imagined. Michael spun slowly towards a bourne from which there was no return. But for now, we were basically gangsters. Not that we pulled any jobs, but we were an elite little circle. Flamboyant and outrageous. Quite honestly, pushing all the margins because it had to be done. Well, there's not much you can really say about acid, except, God, what a trip. Stepping off into this area was very uncertain, uncharted. In the years 1967, 68, there was a real turnover in the feeling of what was going on. A lot of confusion and a lot of experimentation. The most amazing thing that I can remember on acid is watching birds fly. Birds that kept flying in front of my face that weren't actually there. Flocks of birds of paradise. And actually, it was a tree blowing in the wind. I was walking down a country lane. It was very green and I could almost see every wing movement. It was slowed down to the point where I could even say, shit, I could do that. That's why I understand the odd person jumping out of a window, because the whole notion of how it's done is suddenly clear. A flock of birds took about half an hour to fly across my vision, an incredible fluttering, and I could see every feather. And they looked at me while they did it, like, try that on for size. Shit. Okay, there's some things I can't do. You had to be with the right people when you were taking acid. Otherwise, beware. Brian on acid, for example, was a loose cannon. Either he'd be incredibly relaxed and funny, or he'd be one of the cats that would lead you down a bad road when the good road closes. And suddenly you're going there, down the streets of paranoia. And on acid, you can't really control it. Why am I going into his black dot? I just don't want to go there. Let's go back to the crossroads and see if the good road opens. I want to see that flock of birds again and have a few astounding ideas for playing and find the lost chord. The holy grail of music. Very fashionable at the time. there were a lot of pre-Raphaelites running around in velvet with scarves tied to their knees, like the Ormsby Gores, looking for the Holy Grail, the lost court of King Arthur, UFOs and ley lines. With Christopher Gibbs, you actually couldn't tell whether he was on acid or not, because that's the way he was. Maybe I never knew Christopher off acid. But I must say, he was an adventurous lad. He was ready to jump into the unknown, into the valley of death. He was ready to look into it. It was something that had to be done. I never saw Gibbs unbalanced by acid, never saw any sign of a bad trip. My memories of Christopher are that he was somehow always angelically 3 feet off the ground, as we all were, perhaps. No one knew much about this. We were tapping in the dark. I found it very interesting, but at the same time, I found other people got quite distressed. And that's all you need on this kind of stuff, is to deal with somebody who really is having a bad trip. People could change and become very paranoid or very uptight or very scared, especially Brian. It could happen to anybody, but that would turn other people into a bad time too. It was the unknown with acid. You didn't know if you'd come back or not. I had a couple of terrible trips. I remember Christopher talking me down. Hey, everything is cool. It's all right. He was just like a nurse, a night nurse. I can't even remember what the hell I was going through. It just wasn't pleasant. Paranoia, maybe. The same with a lot of people with marijuana. It makes them paranoid. It's basically fear, but you don't know of what, so you have no defence. And the further you go down there, the bigger it gets. Sometimes you've got to slap yourself. But it didn't stop me from having another trip. It was the idea of a boundary that had to be pushed. There's a bit of stupidity there as well. Wasn't so good last time. Let's try it again. What, are you chicken now? It was the acid test, Ken Kesey's goddamn thing. It meant if you hadn't been there, you ain't nowhere, which is really dumb. A lot of people felt obliged to take it, even if they didn't want to, if they wanted to stay and hang with the crowd. It was a gang thing, but it could shake you if you weren't careful, and that happened a lot. Even if you've taken it once, it's probably done something to you. It's too volatile. One epic of that period was an acid-fueled road trip with John Lennon. An episode of such extremes that I can barely piece together a fragment. It took in, I thought, Torquay and Lyme Regis over what seemed like a 2 or 3 day period with the chauffeur. Johnny and I were so out there that sometimes, years later in New York, he would ask, what happened on that trip? With us was Carrie Ann Moeller, now Mrs. Chris Jagger. I think the Hollies wrote a song about her. It was about Marianne. Very sweet girl. Had a place on Portland Square, where I lived when in town for about 2 years. Her reminiscences, which I sought out recently for this book, were quite different from mine. But hers were at least not almost a total blank like mine.